Hemingway's novel, For Whom the Bell Tolls, is set during the Spanish Civil War back in the 1930s. It deals with a small band of loyalists who are operating behind enemy lines. The guerrillas have set themselves up in a cave, waiting to blow up a bridge near Segovia, Spain. The group is led by a man named Pablo, a shifty, unreliable opportunist, and his wife, Filar, who's a determined sort of woman. Tensions rise in the cave as a mood of impending disaster creeps over the group of guerrillas. And then suddenly Pablo deserts, taking with him the dynamite that they need to blow up the bridge. Well, some time goes by, and there's a scene where Pablo returns to the cave with the dynamite after an interval of several days. His wife peers at him in mocking disdain, and he withers under her glance. And then in shame, he blurts out these words: "Having done such a thing, there's a loneliness which cannot be borne." Well, it's Hemingway's way of telling us about the terrible pain of being cut off, of alienation, the frustration of fragmentation. Pablo couldn't stand it alone. He couldn't bear being separated from his comrades. And so in spite of the shame, he returned to the cave. Well, disappointment and frustration, separation, disharmony, a host of other of life's afflictions warn us that things are not the way they ought to be in our lives. And that motivates us to look and to search for something better. Last week we took a look at this text in Genesis and saw that many of the difficulties in Eve's life, and by implication many of the difficulties in our lives, come when we ask the wrong questions. And so those frustrations, that alienation, that fragmentation, often come because we're putting the wrong inquiries to life. We tend to ask questions that focus on ourselves. Is it safe? Will it feel good? What's in it for me? And even the questions that we think are not about ourselves are often actually really about us. And so when we ask, why does God allow suffering, we may really mean, why does God allow me to suffer? When we inquire, why is God unfair, our actual intent is to learn, why has God been unfair to me? And when we wonder, why is God silent in this age, at the heart of that matter is our concern about, why hasn't God talked to me? Perhaps because we tend to ask questions that focus on ourselves, we also tend to look at the book of Genesis, from which this story comes, as the story about the beginning of the human race, the start of humankind. And there may be an element of that there, but that's not actually all there is in the text. There's actually more there. It's the story of God and God dealing with people. When we ask Genesis questions about the beginning of humankind, we come up with all sorts of blanks. We ask, when did all this happen? How long were each of those creative days? When Genesis talks about kinds, does it mean what we mean by species? Where do the cavemen fit into the story? What about Australopithecus? Where do the dinosaurs appear? Where was the Garden of Eden? What was that fruit that Eve and Adam ate? How did they learn about sex? How did Cain know that God didn't approve of his sacrifice? Where did Cain get his wife? Where's the ark at today? And how did it hold all those animals? Well, not one of those questions is answered in this text. We'd like to read here a prehistory of humankind, but what we get in Genesis is the story about a growing relationship between God and the people He's made. Genesis is the story of God. Now, to help us understand that point, it's important to determine what we might call the genre or the nature of the book of Genesis. First of all, it's not a science book. There are no equations or theorems or experiments going on in this 50-chapter volume. It was written in a pre-scientific age. Now, that doesn't mean it's an unscientific book, but just like any other ancient writing, it was written before the rise of modern science and doesn't deal with scientific questions. Likewise, when we look at this book, it's not a book of history. History records the major actions and movements of significant groups of people and cultures. Genesis gives us the tiny details about unimportant people. History offers explanations for why certain major events occur. Genesis does a bit of that, but it mostly focuses on other issues. That doesn't mean Genesis is unhistorical. It just means it's not there to unfold history. Genesis is neither primarily a book of literature, It's not a novel, it's not a short story, it's not a play, it's not a poem. In fact, it doesn't fit into hardly any of our categories of literature, whether ancient or modern. That doesn't mean Genesis is not a great piece of literature, but it does tell us that its focus is not just to tell stories. Well, what is Genesis? What kind of literature is it? Genesis is theology. Theology means teaching about God. Genesis appears in a book of Scripture, in a volume that has been the cornerstone of three of the five world's major of the world's five major faiths. Now, we can approach Genesis as a scientist or as a historian or as a literary critic, but I suspect in the process we will miss much of the message that Genesis has for us. And so if we're only interested in science or what Genesis says about history or literature, we obscure the message altogether. And perhaps the question we should be asking of the book is, what is Genesis saying? Often we come with a predetermined scheme of science or a predetermined scheme of history or literature, and we want to measure Genesis against it. We've already decided what's right, and all that remains to be done is to rewrite Genesis so that it fits. And perhaps we need to ask the question, why does Genesis always have to conform to the principles of anthropology and evolution and literature and Reformation theology? Can Genesis speak on its own? And if it can, what is this book trying to say? Genesis is primarily a narrative. Whenever we read a story, we always want to know who's the main character. If you pick up a novel by Hemingway or a story by Bernard Shaw or a historical novel by James Michener, we want to know who's the central figure of this particular volume. Sometimes, as with a Michener volume, the main character revolves or the main focus revolves around a city or a region. So the central figure ends up being Hawaii or the American West. When you come to Genesis, who's the main character? What is the central focus? Well, Genesis begins in a place called Eden, moves quickly to a mountain called Ararat, then over to Mesopotamia, then to Palestine, finally ends up down in Egypt. The book doesn't focus on one particular place. And there's not one person that moves throughout the whole book. It begins with a couple named Adam and Eve, moves on with a brief glimpse of some of their descendants, then centers on Abraham, then on Jacob, finally on Joseph. Adam and Eve aren't mentioned at the end of the book. Joseph doesn't appear at the first part of the book. There is no central character that runs through the book. Well, perhaps we should look for a central topic in the book of Genesis. It begins with the story of creation, then moves into sin and deals with some other sins. Finally, a description of the flood and how the earth is repopulated after that flood. The central section of the book tells about Abraham's difficulty in having children. A little later, we get the adventures of Jacob. Finally, the rise of Joseph to power. No central topic emerges. Well, what is the book about? Does it have a theme? Does it have a central thesis? Well, there is one issue that continues throughout the book of Genesis. It's mentioned repeatedly. In the first chapter, it's a central focus of the last chapter. Genesis is about God. God is mentioned in 45 of the 50 chapters of the book. There are about 34,000 words in the book of Genesis. 500 of them are the word God. About one out of every 70 words is the word God. In the first 11 chapters, God appears to be there on the scene. He kneels down there beside the muddy riverbank, puts together a creature that looks like a human, breathes into it the breath of life, later does surgery on that creature, makes another one pretty much like it. Or he makes the animals, makes them into living things. A bit later, he's strolling through the garden, runs into two humans hiding in the underbrush. Or he talks to Cain there by the altar where he's watched Abel and his brother offer up sacrifices. And later, as it begins to rain, God comes by and he closes the door on the ark. So God's presence is clearly seen, clearly at the forefront of those first 11 chapters. In the Abraham stories, God regularly appears to this ancestor. Sometimes he comes walking in human form. Sometimes he comes just in the form of a voice. With Jacob, God tends to appear only in dreams, although we had that one occasion where God wrestles with Jacob in an all-night wrestling match. In the last half of the book, God doesn't appear at all personally. He stands in the background, but Joseph makes it clear that he trusts him every step of the way, and that the entire sequence from Dothan to Potiphar's house, from prison to Secretary of State, has been orchestrated by God from behind the scenes. Well, information about this God begins to flow in the very first chapter, somewhere back before people could write, somewhere back before there were any people at all, somewhere back before the earth as we know it existed, there was God. God flexed his muscle in a couple of different ways. First of all, he had this amazing power to say things into existence. And so he said, let there be light. And poof, there was light. Or he said, let the waters be gathered together into oceans and let the dry land appear. And suddenly there were oceans and continents. The other side of his power comes in his ability to make things. It says he made the sun and the moon. The process is not described. We're just told God went to work. Pretty soon in the sky there was a sun and the moon. And then he made or created the animals. Finally, he made the people. Well, clearly, Genesis wants to tell us that the earth was God's idea. Its shape, its status reflects the blueprint that was in his mind. Genesis is not interested in telling how it was done or the details about the process or when it was done, but simply that God stands behind what's here. And so we have the result of what he did. We live on his planet. We cross his oceans. We climb his mountains. We feel the warmth of that sun that he made. We domesticate and use those animals. And that gives us some notion of the authority and the power of the one who stands behind it all. Yet Genesis goes on, as we learned last week in our study of Genesis 3, to tell us about people who reject this power and authority of God. There's Eve, who was tricked into adopting a substitute standard maker. The snake seduced her into believing that she had the right to decide what was right and wrong, to do her own thing. She believed she could rewrite the rules of the garden maker. She believed she knew more about the tree of the knowledge of good and evil than the maker of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil knew. And she set herself up as an authority, as the standard maker. And when she did, life came tumbling in. Or there's Cain, who has that friendly chat with God next to the altar. Cain listened, but not very well, because he proceeds to reject God's counsel, kills his brother. When God inquires about the deed of Cain, Cain proceeds to lie to God. He adopts a whole new set of standards and rejects the power of the standard-making authority belonging to God. 5 generations later, there's a man named Lamech, does exactly what Cain does. And finally, it reaches the point in the time of Noah when everybody, except for one man, paid any attention to the authority of the Creator. But what does all this mean? What is Genesis trying to say to us? How does that apply to where we are in life? I remember one cold winter night talking with a young woman at a large mall. Stores had just closed. She was a clerk in one of the shoe stores. We sat outside her store on a bench and talked. She had left home and taken life into her own hands. She was quite aware of the moral standards that are taught in the Bible. She knew about God. But in a variety of ways, she'd taken a different course with her life. Promiscuity, addiction, fraud, dishonesty. Those were just a few of the things she was into. I'd known this girl since she was 10. We talked for a while about how her behavior was affecting her parents. She loved her parents. She knew that she was hurting them. She said, I've got to live things my way. Can't go their way. We talked about how her actions were being destructive to her personality, to her future. She knew that. Said, I'm more interested in the now than what might be in the later. Finally, I asked her about God. She believed in him. She knew his story. She knew about God's image. She knew about his power. She knew about his kindness. She even knew about his laws. She'd been well taught. Finally, she ended our conversation by saying this. I know what God says. I know what's right and wrong. But I've got to do things my way. I think that young woman represents the thinking of an increasing section of Western society. She believes God. She knows what he says. But in face of all that belief, she says, I've got to do things my way. Now, before we have too much sympathy for the girl, perhaps we ought to ask where it all ends. Where does it stop? What does it lead to? Where do we get the right to decide we're going to do what we want to do? If God doesn't make the moral laws, which is the teaching of Genesis, then who does? Do you want the 17-year-old girls to make them? Do you want the neo-Nazi party to construct our laws? Perhaps we should let Hugh Hefner set our standards. Or maybe the criminal element should decide what's right and wrong in society. Nathan Adam has a book out called Cocaine King, Studying Evil. It's a story of Carlos Lededer, one-time petty car thief, street corner marijuana seller down in Miami. Eventually developed a drug trafficking ring made up of 20 families, headquarters in Colombia. They shipped in the mid-80s nearly 150 tons of cocaine to the United States every year. Lededer, or one of his cohorts, was responsible for killing 3,000 Americans, murdering them during that period of time. Lederer's goal is to have his own country. His idol is Adolf Hitler. Kang Noor played the role of the Cambodian reporter Dith Pran in the 1984 movie The Killing Fields. Just last year, he came out with a book of his own, his experiences in Cambodia, under the title A Cambodian Odyssey. One section of the book where he's been arrested, and he's tied to a cross made out of soccer goalposts. And underneath that cross, his captors build a fire of rice hulls, and he's hung there in the cross for 4 days and 4 nights, feeling his feet roast from the fire. When they took him down, they tied a plastic bag over his head, his hands behind the back, and he thrashed around on the ground trying to breathe. Finally, they took the bag off and gave him some water. Or read the story of Natan Sharansky. He tells it in his book, Fear No Evil. It's on the bestsellers list right now. He tells of his cruel Russian imprisonment that included watching the jailers have sexual activity with the animals. Unrelenting human degradation. Being confined for 403 days to a freezing punishment cell. Kept alive barely by bread and warm water. Well, I could go on. Why do people do these crazy things? Why are such injustices practiced in and outside of our country? Well, it's because they rejected God as standard and set themselves up as the standard. They're going to decide what's right and wrong. And the frightening thing is, there's no basic philosophical difference between the drug lords in Colombia and the Russian prison officials and the vast majority of thinking and seduced contemporary America. I presented this material to Community Focus, Community Forum last month. There were questions and answers afterwards. And one of the questions that came up on a 3x5 card asked this: I hear what you're saying, but I doubt if any of my friends would go as far as the Russians or the cocaine dealers. We feel that if everybody felt like we felt and acted like we act, the extreme things you mentioned wouldn't happen. Well, the point is, they have happened, and they are happening, because people are acting on their own authority. We can't control evil by ourselves. Crime and fraud and pollution, irresponsibility, all stem from the notion that we are our own authority. We're in danger of losing our souls and ending up only with bodies, with cells. We're in danger of losing nature and truth, ending up only with culture and accuracy. We're in danger of losing any sense of God's authority over us because we've bought the notion that whatever God is or wherever God is, He should serve me. It's striking to go back and to reread the words of some of the founding fathers of our country. Works by J. Adams, Second Farewell Address by Washington, the works of Jefferson, and go back before them to the men that they depended upon, Hobbes, Locke. And you'll find that they based our idea of law in the United States on the moral law of God. They didn't look inside themselves. They didn't look to nature. They didn't ask, what's best for me? They didn't ask, will this feel good? They didn't ask, is it safe? But they went back to God. When we turn back to God, when we say God is the authority in life, we ask an entirely different set of questions. Genesis doesn't list them in order, but there are some suggestions here about the kinds of questions we would ask. Chapter 2, verses 16 and 17 suggest that we should ask, what has God said? What does God want? Chapter 1 of Genesis, verse 31, suggests we should ask, what's good? What's right? What's just? Chapter 1, verse 27 of the book of Genesis suggests, what would I do? What kind of decision best reflects the image of God that stamped deep in my soul what has God said, what is good, what best reflects His image. Now, the answers to those questions may not be the safe thing to do. Those answers may not make you feel good. Those answers may not make you comfortable. And they may not get you anything. But they are right. And they are true. You probably heard about Robert Fulghum's bestseller. It's number one right now, I think, on the nonfiction list, titled All I Really Wanted to Know, or All I Really Needed to Know, I Learned in Kindergarten. If you haven't read the book, there's nothing in there that you don't already know. Share, play fair, don't hit people, flush, put things back, wash before you eat. The reviews I've read of the book wonder, why are people buying this book? Is it the clever title? Is it the easy reading? My theory is that there's a deep hunger for simple guidance, for innocent direction, and for uncorrupted boundaries. And the American people. They're looking for a standard. They're looking for an authority. According to Genesis, the ultimate reason for living is God. And the final authority in life, whether it's our individual lives or our corporate lives as a church or as a community, as a culture, the final authority is God. Maybe that you once believed that, but you've been seduced by culture. And I would urge you to put God back as the basic authority in life, and to do what He says. Our lives get fouled up with sin, happens to everybody. The Bible has a way out of that, that it calls salvation. And salvation comes when we put a trusting faith in God, allow that faith to work in our lives, develop in our lives, to the point where we give up some things that we do that are contradictory to what He wants us to do. It brings us to the point of baptism, where we submit to His teaching. He forgives us of sin, ushers us into the kingdom. And He makes us the kind of people that are confessing people, people who are willing to say, I do wrong, and I continue to do wrong. And people are willing to confess that Jesus is Lord, and I want everybody to know. If God needs to be your authority, and you need to go through some part of that process, we'd invite you to come right now as we stand and sing.